Chapter 2. The first day back. Dr. Asha Menon returned with her hand clenched around nothing. For one bright, stupid instant, she thought she had dropped the clamp. Her fingers closed again, empty. The glove was still there, dry, clean. No blood on the latex, no clamp in her hand. That was wrong. Asha stood in the center of an operating theater that was not the theater she had left. The ceiling was whole. The surgical light was newer, smaller, mounted on a different arm. The east wall had been repainted a calm institutional blue, as if color could apologize for structural failure. There was no patient on the table. There was no table. Three residents in street clothes stared at her from the doorway, caught between medical training and the older animal knowledge that something dead had just walked into their lunch hour. One of them dropped a paper cup. Coffee spread across the floor in a dark crescent. Asha looked down at it. For a moment, all she could see was blood leaving a body too quickly. "What year is it?" she asked. No one answered. She asked again, sharper. That worked. Doctors understood sharpness. It gave panic a hierarchy to climb. 2023, one of the residents said. Asha waited for the rest of the sentence. There was no rest. Her last memory was weight falling toward her skull. Her next breath was 5 years later. She put a hand to the back of her head. No fracture, no swelling, no pain except the phantom certainty of impact, clean and diagnostic, repeating under the skin like a result no machine had printed. Unsurvivable. The word rose before she could stop it. Then the hospital alarms began. Not fire, not attack, not structural failure. Too many people, too fast, appearing in rooms that had not held them a second before. The residents ran. Asha followed because the hospital was filling with impossible patients and her own impossible body could wait. Ovek returned under a sky they did not recognize. There had been a roof. There had been no air. There had been stone close enough to become the world. Now there was wind. Ovek was inside the hazard fence, in the cleared circle where the main shaft mouth had been sealed. The ground under their palms was packed hard with sealant dust and old grit. A yellow boundary lamp blinked at knee height. Beyond it, a service road curved toward the memorial gate. Ovek fell to their knees on hard ground and clawed at their throat. Their mouth was full of dust, except it was not. Their ribs hurt, except they did not. Their ears rang with the low broken bell from the second shaft, except the sound came from small metal strips tied along a fence, knocking together in the wind. The fence was new. The extraction lamps were gone. The shaft mouth was gone. In its place stood a field of scrap metal names. Some were welded to posts. Some hung from wire. Some had been painted by careful hands and repainted by hands less careful. Gifts sat at the base of the fence. Cracked bowls, strips of cloth, worker tags, little packets of food gone hard in the weather. Ovek did not move. The mountain had been opened, emptied, covered, and explained. A sign beside the gate said, "Loss Event Site," in three official languages. Beneath it, someone had scratched another word so deeply the metal curled outward around the letters, "Murder." Ovek did not know how long they knelt there before the first person saw them. An old man on the public side of the fence dropped the bundle he was carrying. The cloth came loose around a stack of thin metal strips, each punched with a name too small for the official plates. He wore the grey shoulder wrap of a sitekeeper, but a black mourning line had been painted straight through it. He said a name. Not Ovex. Then another. His voice kept breaking around the names, as if each one had a bone inside it. Ovek tried to tell him they were not those people. Their mouth opened. The wrong voice came out. "My child is not listed," Ovek said. One strip lay face up against the gate. "Child of Marek." "Unlisted." The old man covered his face. Only then did Ovek understand that something had followed them back, wearing the names of the dead. Nia Reyes returned in the middle of a crosswalk that no longer had the same paint. The white bars were wider now, fresh, city standard. There was a bike lane where the curb used to be and a plastic post flexing in the rain. Someone had put a little metal plaque on the signal pole low enough that people could touch it without reaching. Nia did not notice the plaque at first. She noticed the bus. It braked hard enough to throw everyone inside forward. The driver slammed a hand against the horn, then froze behind the wheel when Nia looked at him. A cyclist cursed. A woman on the sidewalk screamed and then started laughing. Cars stopped crooked through the intersection, each driver staring at Nia like she had fallen out of the weather. Her tote bag hit the ground beside her, still full, still heavy. The carton of soup she had bought before work rolled out and settled against the curb. Nia stared at it. She had been speaking to Tessa. The thought arrived calmly, almost politely. She had been speaking to Tessa, and Tessa had been about to say something back. Nia turned. No Tessa. Tess? The intersection gave her traffic noise, rainwater, brake hiss, a far-off siren. Tessa. Someone approached with both hands lifted, like Nia might bolt or break. A young man in a city maintenance vest. Older than he should have been. Everyone looked older than they should have been, but Nia did not know that yet. "Mom," he said, "are you hurt?" Nia looked down at herself. Same shoes, same coat, same scrape on her thumbnail from the filing cabinet that morning. Morning, she laughed once. It did not sound like her. "Where's Tessa?" The man in the vest went pale. That was when Nia noticed the plaque bolted to the signal pole. Tessa Kim, 1991-2018. The rest of the words blurred before Nia could make them obey. Somewhere under the traffic, under the rain, under the man asking if she needed to sit down, Nia heard tires screaming toward a place where she was not standing anymore, and Tessa still was. Saar returned to a cell with no door. For several breaths, she did not understand that this was mercy. Her body remembered bindings. Her wrists expected pain. Her knees expected the execution field's hard black stone. Instead, she stood barefoot in dust, under a ceiling cracked by years of weather, with sunlight falling through a hole where the locking wall had been cut away. The tablet was gone. The banners were gone. The drone was gone. The sentence had not finished. Saar turned slowly. The cell block had been abandoned long enough for vines to enter through the upper vents. Someone had painted over the surveillance eyes. Someone else had painted over the paint. There were names on the walls, hundreds of them, scratched into stone and metal and the old polymer bunks. Some names had marks beside them, returned, dead, unknown. Saar found her provisional designation near the lower wall, Saar Ven. Beside it, in a different hand, dusted during sentence, and beneath that, smaller, omen. Saar touched the word. The dust came away on her fingers. Voices rose outside the broken corridor, not guards, not officials. People arguing in the yard beyond the prison shell. No one is supposed to be in there. I saw movement. If it is one of them, don't touch her. Her. The word was not the problem. The problem was the way they said it. Softly, carefully, as if she had returned as evidence instead of a person. Saar stepped into the sunlight. The yard went silent. Some people knelt. Some ran. One young guard, barely old enough to wear the uniform, raised a weapon with shaking hands and then lowered it just as quickly, ashamed of his own reflex. Saar looked past him, past the ruined gate, toward the city that had outlived her death and revised itself without asking her name. Somewhere beneath the silence, she heard water where there was no water. She had been refused an ending. She did not yet know whether to call that rescue or theft. Mara Vale returned already moving, her hand snapped forward and found Daniel Keane's sternum. Not the ambulance floor, not the cabinets, not the impact, wet pavement, cold air, rain. Dan lay half on his side in the middle of an intersection that was not the one Mara remembered, and exactly the one Mara remembered. The road had been repaved. A traffic camera hung above a newer signal. The old median was gone. Flowers had been tied to a utility pole beneath a laminated photograph of a man in an ambulance uniform. Mara saw none of that first. She saw Dan. His lips were blue. His wedding ring was still on. No, she said, and this time the word was useful. She rolled him flat, checked airway, checked pulse. Too fast, wrong rhythm, but there. Alive enough to fight for. Her hands knew what to do before her mind had any room for 5 missing years. People shouted around her. Someone said, "They came back." Someone else said, "Call 911. Mara almost laughed because she was 911, or had been, or would be again if the universe could stop ending for one goddamn minute. "Dan," she said, "you stay with me." His eyes fluttered. Elena? Not yet. She started compressions when his pulse slipped, counted under her breath, 30. Airway. Breath, again. The siren came from far away, too far, then closer, then everywhere. 5 years arrived in pieces while she worked. The people holding phones too thin to be hers, the faces behind masks, the missing ambulance wreckage, the old driver in the laminated photograph by the pole, his name printed under the image, Ray Alvarez, beloved husband, father, paramedic. Mara's hands did not stop. Dan coughed under her, once, then again. He dragged air into his chest like it hurt him. Good, Mara said, and her voice broke on the word. Good. Do that again. The new ambulance arrived at an angle, red-orange light washing across the wet road. The paramedics who jumped out were children. No, not children, just younger than she had any right to resent. I'm a paramedic, Mara said. One of them looked at her clothes, at her face, at the impossible age of her uniform patch. His expression changed. Were, he said softly. Mara looked down. Her certification badge hung from her belt, 5 years out of date. Dan reached for her wrist, weak, real. Elena, he said again. We'll find her, Mara said. She did not know if that was true. She said it anyway. The ambulance light slid across the wet pavement, and for one breath it looked like sunset on a shore that had no sun. That night, Asha dreamed of black water under an orange sky. No hospital, no ceiling, no alarm, only a horizon so bright it hurt to diagnose. Ovek dreamed of names floating just beneath the surface, each one trying to rise without a mouth. Nia dreamed she was standing in a crosswalk that ended at the edge of a sea. Saar dreamed her unfinished name had washed up at her feet, written in a hand she did not recognize. Mara dreamed of the last second before impact stretched wide enough to hold the world. Somewhere unseen, a sixth sleeper opened his eyes in the dark. What did it cost? He whispered,